too. A colleague called me in Utah this morning after Donovan called him. I left everything behind and got myself on a plane. Who do they suspect? I have no idea. From what I've heard, Jack and Bennett were both out last night. Christy went to bed early, and Donovan was watching TV upstairs in their sitting room. Myrna's apartment is off the kitchen and back, but she says she was dead to the world and didn't hear anything. She's currently down at the station being interviewed. Christy came in a little while ago. She says the detectives are still talking to Donovan. Hang on. She put a hand across the mouthpiece, and I heard her in a muffled discussion with someone in the background. She came back on the line saying, "Great. I just talked to the homicide detective in charge of things here. He wants to keep the phone line open, but says if you want to come over, he'll tell the guys at the gate to let you in. I told him he ought to talk to you since you were the one who found Guy in the first place. I told him you might have something to contribute." "I doubt that, but who knows? I'll be there in 15 minutes. Do you need anything?" "We're fine for the moment. If no one's at the gate, the code is 1924. Just punch the number in at the call box beside the drive." "See you shortly," she said. I grabbed my blazer and my handbag and went out to my car. The day had been mild. The high winds had moved on, taking with them the unseasonable heat. The light was waning, and as soon as the sun set, the temperatures would drop. I was already chilled, and I shrugged into my blazer before I slid beneath the wheel. Earlier in the day, I'd tried to use my wipers and washer fluid to clean the dust off my windshield, and now it was streaked in a series of rising half-moons. The hood of my car was covered with the same fine layer of dust, as pale as powder, and just as soft by the look of it. Even the seat upholstery had a gritty feel to it. I put my hands together on the steering wheel and leaned my forehead against them. I had absolutely no feeling. My interior process was held in suspended animation, as if the pause button had been pushed on some remote control. How was it possible Guy Malik was gone? For the past week, he'd been such a presence in my life. He'd been both lost and found. He'd occupied my thoughts, triggering reactions of sympathy and exasperation. Now I couldn't quite remember his face. Only a flash here and there. The sound of his, "Hey," the whiskery brush of his chin on my cheek. He was already as insubstantial as a ghost, all form without content, a series of fragmented images without permanence. What seemed so odd was that life just went on. I could see traffic passing along Cabana Boulevard. 2 doors away, my neighbor raked brittle leaves into a pile on his lawn. If I turned on the car radio, there'd be intervals of music, public service announcements, commercials, and news broadcasts. Guy Malik might not even be mentioned on some stations. I'd lived my entire day without any intuition that Guy had been murdered. No tremor whatsoever in my subterranean landscape. So what's life about? Are people not really dead until we've been irrefutably informed? It felt that way to me, as though Guy had just this moment been jettisoned out of this world and into the next. I turned the key in the ignition. Every ordinary act seemed fraught with novelty. My perceptions had changed, and with them many of my assumptions about my personal safety. If Guy could be murdered, why not Henry, or me? I drove on automatic pilot while the street scene slid past. Familiar neighborhoods looked odd, and there was a moment when I couldn't recall with any certainty what town I was in. Approaching the Malik's, I could see that traffic had increased. Cars filled with the curious cruised by the estate. Heads were turned almost comically in the same direction. There were cars parked on both sides of the road out front. Tires had chewed into the grass, plowing down bushes and crushing the stray saplings. As each new car appeared, the assembled crowd would turn, craning and peering to see if it was someone of note. My car didn't seem to generate a lot of interest at first. I guess nobody could believe the Maleks would drive a VW Bug, especially one like mine, with its dust and assorted dings. It was only when I pulled up at the gate and gave my name to the guard that the reporters surged forward, trying to catch a glimpse of me. They seemed to be fresh troops. I didn't recognize anyone from my earlier trip over. Somehow the national media had already managed to get camera crews assembled, and I knew that by 7 the next morning, someone closely associated with the Maleks would be seen in a 3-minute interview. I don't know how the major networks make arrangements so quickly. It was one of the miracles of technology that less than 24 hours after Guy Malek's death, somebody would do a close-up of a tear-stained face. Maybe Christie's or Myrna's or even Enid's, the cook I'd yet to meet. There was a black-and-white patrol car parked to one side, along with a vehicle from a private firm. I spotted the security guard pacing along the road, trying to keep the crowd from moving in too close. A uniformed police officer checked my name on his clipboard and waved me in. The gate swung inward by degrees, and I idled the engine until the gap was sufficient to ease through. In that brief interval, there were strangers knocking on my car window, yelling questions in my direction. With their various handheld mics extended, they might have been offering gimcracks for sale. I kept my eyes straight ahead. When I pulled forward through the gate, two male reporters continued to trot alongside me like cut-rate Secret Service agents. The security guard and the cop both converged, cutting off their progress. In my rearview mirror, I could see them begin to argue with the officer, probably reciting their moral, legal, and constitutional rights. My heart rate picked up as I eased up the driveway toward the house. I could see 5 or 6 uniformed officers prowling across the property, eyes on the ground, as if hunting for 4-leaved clovers. Light tended to fade rapidly at this hour of the day. Shadows were already collecting beneath the trees. Soon they'd need flashlights to continue the search. There was a second uniformed officer posted at the front door, his face impassive. He walked out to meet my car, and I rolled down my window. I gave him my name and watched him scan both his list and my face. Apparently satisfied, he stepped away from the car. In the courtyard to my left, there were already numerous cars jammed into the cobblestone turnaround. "Any place in here all right?"
"You can park in the rear. Then come around and use the front door to go in," he said, and motioned me on.
"Thanks." I pulled around to the left and parked my car at the far end of the 3-car garage. In the diminishing light, a cluster of 3 floods activated by motion sensors flashed on to signal my presence. Except for the kitchen on this end of the house and the library on the other, most of the windows along the front of the house were dark. Around the front, the exterior lighting seemed purely decorative, too pale to provide a welcome in the accumulating gloom. The uniformed police officer opened the door for me, and I passed into the foyer. The library door was ajar, and a shaft of light defined one pie-shaped wedge of the wood parquet floor. Given the quiet in the house, I was guessing the technicians were gone. Fingerprint experts, the photographer, the crime scene artist, coroner, and paramedics. Tasha appeared in the doorway.
"I saw you pull in. How are you doing?"
I said, "Fine," in a tone that encouraged her to keep her distance from me. I noticed I was feeling churlish, as much as with her as with circumstances. Homicide makes me angry with its sly tricks and disguises. I wanted Guy Malek back, and with some convoluted emotional logic, I blamed her for what had happened. If she hadn't been my cousin, she wouldn't have hired me in the first place. If I hadn't been hired, I wouldn't have found him, wouldn't even have known who he was, wouldn't have cared, and would have felt no loss. She knew this as well as I did, and the flicker of guilt that crossed her face was a mirror to mine. For someone who'd flown back from her vacation in haste, Tasha was flawlessly turned out. She wore a black gabardine pantsuit with a jacket cropped at the waist. The slim, uncuffed trousers had a wide waistband and inverted pleats in front. The jacket had brass buttons, and the sleeves were trimmed with a thin gold braid. Somehow, the outfit suggested something more than fashion. She looked crisp, authoritative, and diminutive, the dainty MP of lawyers here to keep matters straight. I followed her into the library with its clusters of dark red, cracked leather chairs. The red oriental carpets looked drab at this hour. The tall leaded glass windows were tinted with the gray cast of twilight, as chilly as frost. Tasha paused to turn on table lamps as she crossed the room. Even the luster of the dark wood paneling failed to lend coziness to the cold stone hearth. The room was shabby and smelled as musty as I remembered it. I'd first met Bennett here just a week ago. I left my handbag beside a club chair and circled the room restlessly. "Who's the chief investigator? You said there was someone here."
"Lieutenant Robb."
"Jonah? Oh, terrific. How perfect."
"You know him?"
"I know Jonah," I said. When I'd met him, he was working missing persons, but the Santa Teresa Police Department has a mandatory rotation system, and detectives get moved around. With Lieutenant Dolan's retirement, there was an opening for a homicide investigator. I'd had a short-lived affair with Jonah once, when he was separated from his wife, a frequent occurrence in the course of their stormy relationship. They'd been sweethearts in seventh grade, and were no doubt destined to be together for life, like owls, except for the intervals of virulent estrangement coming every 10 months. I suppose the pattern should have been evident, but I was smitten with him. Later, not surprisingly, she crooked her little finger and he went back to her. Occasionally now, the three of us crossed paths out in public, and I'd become an expert at pretending I'd never dallied with him between my Wonder Woman sheets. This probably accounted for his willingness to have me on the scene. He knew he could trust me to keep my mouth shut.
"What's the story?" she asked.
"Nothing. Just skip it. I feel bitchy, I guess, but I shouldn't take it out on you." I heard footsteps on the stairs and looked up as Christy came in. She wore bulky running shoes and a warm-up suit in some silky material, the blue of the fabric setting off the blue in her eyes. She wore scarcely any makeup, and I wondered if this was the outfit she was wearing when Guy's body was discovered. The library, like the living room, was equipped with a wet bar, a small brass sink, a mini refrigerator, an ice bucket, and a tray of assorted liquor bottles. She moved over to the fridge and removed a chilled bottle of white wine.
"Anybody want a glass of wine? What about you, Kinsey?"
I said, "Alcohol won't help."
"Don't be absurd. Of course it will. So does Valium. It doesn't change reality, but it improves your attitude. Tasha, can I interest you in a glass of Chardonnay? This is top of the line."
She turned the bottle so she could peer at the price tag on the side.
"Nice. This is $36.95. "I'll have some in a bit. Not just yet," Tasha said.
Mutely, the two of us watched while Christy cut the foil cap from a wine bottle and used a corkscrew.
"If I smoked, I'd have a ciggy, but I don't," she said.
She poured herself some wine. The bottle clinked clumsily on the rim of the Waterford crystal.
"Shit,"
she said, pausing to inspect the damage. A jagged crack ran down the side. She dumped the contents in the sink and tossed the glass in the trash. She picked up a second glass and poured again.
"We need a fire in here. I wish Donovan were home."
"I can do that," I said. I moved over to the hearth and removed the fire screen. There were 6 or 7 hefty pieces of firewood in a brass carrier. I picked up one and chunked it onto the grate.
"Make sure you don't destroy any evidence," she said.
I looked up at her blankly.
"Ted Bundy killed one of his victims with a hunk of wood," she said, and then shrugged with embarrassment. "Never mind. Not funny."
"What a day," she said. "I can't figure out how to handle it. I felt drunk since this morning, completely out of control." I stacked 2 more logs on the grate while she and Tasha talked. It was a relief to be involved in a task that was basic and inconsequential. The wood was beautifully seasoned oak. Most of the heat would go straight up the chimney, but it would be a comfort nonetheless. I flicked on the electric match, turned the key in the gas starter, and listened to the comforting whunk as the jets ignited. I replaced the fire screen, pausing to adjust the height of the flame. Belatedly, I tuned into their conversation. Tasha was saying, "Did you ask to have an attorney present?"
"Of course I didn't ask for an attorney. I didn't do anything. This was just routine," Christy said irritably.
She remained standing behind the bar, leaning against its leather surface.
"Sorry. What's the matter with me? I'm completely frazzled." Don't worry about it. Who's still down there?
Jack and Bennett, I think. They kept everybody separated like they did here. So absurd. What do they think, Donovan and I aren't going to discuss it in detail the minute we can put our heads together?
They don't want to risk your influencing one another, I said. Memory's fragile. It's easily contaminated.
None of us have anything much to report, she said. I drank too much at dinner and fell asleep by 9. Donovan was watching TV in the sitting room off our bedroom.
What about Guy?
He went up to bed about the same time I did. He was drunk as all get-out thanks to Bennett's martinis.
She caught sight of her fingertips and frowned to herself. She turned away from us and ran water in the sink.
They took prints for comparison.
Tasha directed a brief comment to me.
After the body was removed and the fingerprint techs were finished, the homicide investigator had one of the Malik's house-cleaning crew come over and walk through Guy's room with him, describing the usual position of furniture, lamps, ashtrays, that sort of thing.
Did they find anything?
I have no idea. I'm sure she was cautioned to keep her mouth shut. I know they tagged and bagged a bunch of items, but I don't know exactly what or why they were significant. Now they've brought in additional officers and started a grid search of the grounds. Apparently they spent a lot of time down in the pool house earlier.
Christy broke in.
I could see them from up in my room checking perimeter gates, any point of entrance or exit.
They're still out there on the property. I noticed that when I came in.
But why check the exterior? It almost had to be someone in the house.
Christy bristled.
Not necessarily. What makes you say that? We have people all over. Maybe 15 a week with the gardeners and the car washers, house cleaners and the woman who takes care of the plants. We have no idea where those people come from. For all we know, they're convicted felons or escapees from a mental institution.
I wasn't going to speak to her flight of fancy. If the notion gave her comfort, let her hang on to it.
It's always possible, I said, but I'm assuming none of them have access to the house at night.
I thought you had an alarm system.
Well, we do. The police were interested in the system as well, but that's the problem, she said. With all the high winds we've had here the past couple of days, windows were blowing open and the alarm kept going off. It happened twice Monday night after we'd all gone to bed. Scared the shit out of me. We finally turned it off so it wouldn't happen again. Last night the system wasn't on at all.
When do they think Guy was killed? I asked.
Around 10, I gather. Between 10 and 11. The detective didn't actually say that, but I noticed that was the period that seemed to interest him. Bennett and Jack were both out until late.
A woman in a housekeeper's uniform with an apron tied over it peered in at the door. She was short and round and looked like someone whose eating habits had long ago outstripped any fat-burning activities. She was probably in her mid-40s, with dark hair pulled back neatly under a red and white bandana she'd wrapped around her head. I wasn't sure if the purpose was ornamental or meant to keep falling hair from seasoning the food.
Excuse me. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm wondering what time you want dinner served.
Christy made a face.
My fault, Enid. I should have talked to you. Donovan's not back yet, and I'm not really sure about Jack and Bennett. What are we having? Will it hold?
Baked chicken breasts. I stopped off at the market on my way into work. I went ahead and changed the menu, so there's plenty if you're having extra people. I did up some oven-roasted potatoes and a casserole of sweet and sour cabbage. I can wait and serve if you like.
Somehow she managed to indicate without a word that waiting around to serve dinner was the last choice on her list.
No, 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 I don't want you to do that. Just leave things in the oven and we can help ourselves. As soon as you're ready, go ahead and take off. I know you were in early.
Yes, ma'am. Myrna called me. I came as soon as I heard.
Have the police talked to you? I'm assuming they have. They talked to everyone else.
Enid picked at her apron uncomfortably. I talked to Lieutenant Bauer shortly before you did, I believe.
Do you want me tomorrow at the usual time?
I don't know yet. Call me in the morning and we'll see what's going on. I may want you here early if that's all right with you.
Of course.
As soon as she withdrew, Christy said,
Sorry for the interruption.
That's Enid Pressman. She's the cook. I guess I could have introduced you. I didn't mean to be rude. Tasha's met her before.
That's perfectly all right, I said. I made a quick mental note to have a chat with Enid at some point. She'd neatly avoided relating much in the way of information.
Tasha said, Maybe I will have that drink. Here, let me get it. You look exhausted. We need to sit.
Christy had put the wine bottle in a cooler and now grabbed two more glasses. Tasha moved over to the bar and took the cooler from her, setting it down on a table between two chairs. Christy quizzed me with a gesture, asking if I was ready to have wine.
I'm fine for now, but go ahead, I said.
Christy curled up in one of the leather chairs. She tucked her legs under her and crossed her arms. I took the chair closest to the fireplace while Tasha perched on the arm of the chair next to Christie's. Tasha said,
What about Bennett? Where was he last night?
I'm not really sure. You'd have to ask him about that.
And Jack? Over at the country club with 100 other fellows. There's a pro-am tournament coming up this weekend. Practice rounds start on Thursday. He went to the pairings party with a friend of his.
That should be easy enough to verify, Tasha said.
Would you quit talking like that? He didn't kill Guy, and neither did I.
Christy, I'm not accusing you. I'm trying to analyze your position here. Given the situation, suspicion's bound to fall on one of you. I don't mean you specifically, so don't take offense. Other people may have access to the property, but who'd have a better motive than the family? There's a lot of money at stake.
But, Tasha, that's ridiculous. If one of us were going to kill him, why do it here? Why not somewhere else? Make it look like an accident or random violence.
I raised my hand like a student. Think of the convenience. If you kill a man in his sleep, you don't have to worry about him putting up a fight.
Jonah Robb appeared in the doorway, his gaze fixed on Christy.
We'll be taking off shortly. The bedroom's still sealed pending the coroner's report. It's strictly off limits until you hear from us. We'll be here early tomorrow morning to finish things up.
Of course. Will there be anything else?
I understand your brother-in-law received some mail.
We gave that to the other detective, Lieutenant Bauer.
Jonah nodded.
Fine. I'll check with her.
Do you have any idea what time we can expect my husband? When I left the station, he was still being interviewed.
I'll have him call if he's there when I get back to the station. With luck, he'll be done and on his way home.
Thanks.
Jonah's gaze came to rest on mine, and he tilted his head.
Can I see you out here?
I got up and crossed the room. He held the door open, and we went into the hall. He said,
Donovan tells us you were the one who located Guy on behalf of the estate.
That's right.
We're going to want to talk to you in the morning, picking up background information.
Of course. Glad to help. I can stop by at 9 on my way into work, I said.
What's this business about the mail?
I haven't seen it yet,
he said obliquely, meaning none of your beeswax.
We looked at each other for perhaps half a moment longer than was absolutely essential.
I'd always thought Jonah was good-looking. Black Irish, I think they call them. Blue eyes, coal-black hair. He looked worn out and tense, his eyes surrounded by a lacework of fine lines, his skin looking coarser than I remembered. Perhaps as a side effect of my renewed sexuality, I found myself sizing up the men in my life. With Jonah, there was a dark radiance in the air. I felt like a fruit fly, wondering if the pheromones were mine or his.
How's Camilla?
She's pregnant.
Congratulations.
It's not mine.
Ah.
What about you? You involved with anyone these days?
Could be. It's hard to know.
His smile was brief.
See you in the morning.
That you will, I thought.
Chapter 14. Once Jonah was gone, I found myself reluctant to return to the library. I could hear Christy and Tasha talking together companionably, their voices light, the conversation interspersed with nervous laughter. The subject had obviously changed. The ego is ill-prepared to deal with death for long. Even at a wake or a funeral, the topic tends to drift to safer ground whenever possible. I scanned the empty foyer, trying to get my bearings. Across from the library was the living room. I'd been in there, but I'd never seen the rest of the ground floor. I passed under the stairs to an intersecting corridor that branched off in both directions. I caught a glimpse of a powder room across the hall. I saw two doors on the right, but both were closed. Under the circumstances, I thought it unwise to snoop indiscriminately. In the unlikely event I encountered a cop, I was roaming in the guise of someone looking for the kitchen, so I could offer my help. Before, the house had felt comfortable, despite the touches of shabbiness that appeared throughout. Now I was acutely aware of the imprint of Guy's murder. The very air seemed heavy, the gloom as languorous as a dense fog drifting through the rooms. I took a left, moving toward the unhappy scent of cooked cabbage at the end of the hall. In a sudden glimpse of the future, I could envision the day when this house would be sold to a private boys' school, and the smell of cruciform vegetables would overpower all else. Young lads in hard shoes would clatter through the halls between classes. The room where Guy had been bludgeoned to death would be turned into a dormitory, where adolescent boys would abuse themselves surreptitiously after lights out. Always there would be rumors about the pale apparition gliding down the corridor, hovering on the landing at the turn of the stairs. I found myself walking quickly, anxious for human company. Beyond the dining room and butler's pantry, the swinging door to the kitchen stood open. The room looked vast to me, but then my entire culinary kingdom would fit in the rear of a moderately priced station wagon. The floors were pale, glossy, pegged oak planks stretching out in all directions. The custom cupboards were dark cherry, and the counters were topped with mottled green marble. There were sufficient cookbooks, utensils, and small appliances in view to furnish one small section of a Williams-Sonoma retail outlet. The stovetop looked bigger than the double bed in my loft, and the refrigerator had clear doors with all the contents on view. To the right, there was the equivalent of a little sitting area, and beyond there was a glassed-in porch that extended the entire length of the room. Here the lush scent of roast chicken and garlic overrode the odor of cooked cabbage. Why does someone else's cooking always smell so much better than your own? Myrna had come back from the police station. She and Enid were standing together near one of the two kitchen sinks. Myrna's face looked puffy, and the prickle of red around her eyes suggested she'd been crying. Not within the last few minutes, but perhaps earlier in the day. Enid had pulled on a poplin raincoat, and the yards of tan fabric gave her the hapless form and shape of a baked potato. She'd removed her bandana. Bareheaded, she had a wiry bird's nest of hair that was dark strands streaked with gray. Tea mugs in hand, they must have been having a few last words about the murder, because both looked up guiltily as I came in. Given their proximity to events, the two of them must have been privy to just about everything. Certainly the family wasn't shy about airing their conflicts. God knows they'd squabbled in front of me. Enid and Myrna must have picked up on plenty and probably compared notes. Enid said, "Can I help you?" She was using the same tone museum guards take when they think you're about to reach out and touch something on the far side of the rope. "That's what I came to ask," I said. "Can I do anything to help?" Little Miss Goody Two-Shoes working on a Girl Scout merit badge. "Thanks, but everything's under control," she said. She emptied her mug in the sink, opened the dishwasher, and set it in the top rack. "I better go while I can," she murmured. Myrna said, "I can walk you out if you want." "I'll be fine," Enid replied. "I can turn on the lights and back." And then, with a look at me, "Can I fix you a cup of tea? The water's hot. I'm just on my way out, but it won't take but a minute." "I'd like that," I said. I'm not that fond of tea, but I had hoped to prolong the contact. "I can do it," Myrna said. "You go on." "Are you sure?" "Absolutely. We'll see you tomorrow." Enid reached out and patted Myrna on the arm. "Well, bye-bye. I want you to talk to my chiropractor about that bursitis, and you call if you need me. I'll be home all evening." Enid took up a wide canvas tote and disappeared through the utility room, moving toward the back door. I watched Myrna plug in the electric tea kettle. She opened a cabinet nearby and took down a mug. Wincing, she reached for a canister and removed a tea bag that she placed in the mug. Meanwhile, outside, I could hear a car door slam shut, and moments later the sound of Enid starting her car. I moved over to the counter and perched on a wooden stool.
"How are you doing, Myrna? You look tired," I said.
"That's my bursitis flaring up. It's been bothering me for days," she said.
"The stress probably contributes."
Myrna pursed her lips.
"That's what my doctor says. I thought I'd seen everything. I'm used to death. In my job, I see a lot of it. But this..."
She paused to shake her head.
"It must have been hellish around here today. I could hardly believe it when Tasha told me," I said.
"You've worked for the Maleks, what, 8 months?"
"About that. Since last April. The family asked me to stay on after Mr. Malek died. Somebody had to take responsibility for running the house. Enid was tired of doing it, and I didn't mind. I've managed many a household, some of them a lot bigger than this."
"Couldn't you be making a lot more money as a private duty nurse?"
She took down a sugar bowl and found a creamer that she filled from a carton of half and half in the refrigerator.
"Well, yes, but I needed some relief from all the terminal illness. I become attached to my patients, and where does that leave me when they pass? I was living like a gypsy, moving from job to job. Here I have a small apartment of my own, and the duties are largely supervisory. I do like cooking occasionally on Enid's nights off, but that's about it. Of course, they complain. They're hard to please sometimes, but I don't let it bother me. In some ways, I'm used to it. The sick are often difficult, and it doesn't mean anything. I let it roll right off me."
"I take it you were here last night."
The tea kettle began a hoarse whisper that rapidly turned into a shriek. She paused to unplug it, and the shrill sound subsided as though with relief. I waited while she filled the mug and brought it over to me.
"Thanks."
I could see her hesitate, apparently debating with herself about her next comment.
"Is something bothering you?" I asked.
"I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say," she hesitated. "The lieutenant asked us not to talk to the press."
"Not surprising," I said. "Have you seen him out there?"
"Like vultures," she remarked. "When I came back from the station, they were all yelling and vying for my attention, pushing microphones in my direction. Made me want to pull my jacket right up over my face. I felt like one of those criminals you see on the television."
"It's probably only going to get worse. This started out as a minor human interest story. Now it's big news."
"I'm afraid so," she said.
"But to answer your question, yes, I was here, but I didn't hear anything. I've had trouble sleeping lately with this arm of mine. Ordinary analgesics don't begin to touch the pain, so I'd taken a Tylenol with codeine and a prescription sleeping pill. I don't do that often because I dislike the effect. Leaves me feeling logy the next morning, like I never quite wake up. Also, I find the sleep so deep it's almost not restful. I went to bed about 8:30 and didn't stir until nearly 9 this morning."
"Who discovered the body?"
"I believe it was Christy."
"What time was this?"
"Shortly after 10. I'd made myself a cup of coffee and I was back here in the kitchen watching the morning news on that little TV set. I heard all the commotion. They were supposed to meet for breakfast to talk about the will, and when Guy didn't come down, I guess Bennett got furious. He thought Guy was playing games. At least that's what Christy told me later. Bennett sent her upstairs to fetch him. Next thing I knew, they dialed 911, but I still wasn't sure what was going on. I was just on my way out there when Donovan came in. He looked awful. He'd lost all his color and was white as a sheet."
"Did you see the body?"
"I did, yes. He asked if I'd go up. He thought there might be something I could do, but of course there wasn't. Guy must have been dead several hours by then."
"There's no doubt?"
"Oh, none, absolutely. He was cold to the touch and his skin was waxen. His skull had been crushed and there was blood everywhere, most of it dried or congealed. Given his injuries, I'd say death must have been quick, if not instantaneous. Also messy. I know the police have been puzzled by that aspect of the murder."
"Which aspect?"
"What the killer did with his own clothes. Not to be gross about it, but there would have been quite an area of splatter. Blood and brain material. There's no way you could leave the premises without attracting attention. The detectives were interested in a number of articles of clothing. They asked for my help since I take items to the cleaners.
Did they find anything significant?
I don't know. I gave them everything that was going out today. They talked to Enid at length, but I'm not sure what they wanted with her.
You have any idea what the weapon was?
I wouldn't hazard a guess. That's not an area where I feel qualified to comment. There was nothing in the room, at least as far as I could see. I did hear one of the detectives say the autopsy was scheduled first thing tomorrow morning. I imagine the medical examiner will have an opinion, she said.
Have you been hired by the family to investigate?
I could feel the lie form, but then thought better of it. I said, not yet. Let's hope it doesn't come to that. I can't believe anybody in the family is going to turn out to be responsible.
I expected her to pipe up with protests and reassurances, but the quiet that followed was significant. I could sense a desire to confide, but I couldn't imagine what. I let my gaze rest on hers with an expression I hoped appeared trustworthy and encouraging. I could almost feel my head tilt like a dog trying to decipher the direction of a high-pitched whistle. She'd become aware of a dried speck on the counter, and she worked at it with her fingernail, not looking at me.
This is really none of my business. I had only respect for Mr. Malik.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't want anyone to think badly of me, but I can't help but hear things while I'm going about my business. I'm paid well, and God knows I enjoy the work. Or at least I did.
I'm sure you're only trying to help, I said, wondering where she was going with this.
You know, Bennett never agreed to share the money. He wasn't convinced that was Bader's intention, and neither was Jack. Of course, Jack sided with Bennett in just about everything.
Well, maybe they weren't convinced, but given the missing will, I don't know what choice they had short of court action.
I gather nothing was settled. Not at all. If they'd settled their business, Guy would have gone home. He was miserable here. I could see it in his face.
Well, that's true. When I talked to him on Monday, he admitted he'd been drinking.
Oh, especially last night. They started with cocktails and went through 4 or 5 bottles of wine with dinner, and then port and liqueurs. It was still going on when I went off to bed. I helped Enid with the dishes, and she could see how exhausted I was. Both of us heard them quarreling.
Bennett and Guy quarreled?
She shook her head, lips moving. I cupped a hand to my ear.
Excuse me? I didn't hear that.
She cleared her throat and raised her voice half a notch.
Jack. Guy and Jack quarreled before Jack went off to his country club. I told the lieutenant about it, and now I'm wondering if I should have kept my mouth shut.
The truth is the truth. If that's what you heard, you had to tell the police.
You don't think he'll be mad?
Her tone was anxious, her expression almost childlike in its apprehension. I suspected the entire family would have fits when they heard, but we all had an obligation to cooperate with the police investigation.
Maybe so, but you can't worry about that. Guy was murdered last night. It's not up to you to protect anyone.
She nodded mutely, but I could see she remained unconvinced. Myrna, I mean this. Whatever happens, I don't think you should feel responsible.
But I didn't have to volunteer the information. I like Jack. I can't believe he'd hurt anyone.
Listen, you think I'm not going to end up in the same position? The cops are going to talk to me, too. I have to go down there tomorrow, and I'm going to end up doing exactly what you did.
You are?
Of course. I heard them quarrel the night I came here for drinks. Bennett and Donovan were going at it hammer and tongs. Christy was the one who told me they did it all the time.
That doesn't make them killers, but it's not up to us to interpret the facts.
You have to tell the cops what you heard. I'm sure Enid will back you up. Nobody's going to be arrested on that basis anyway. It's not like you saw Jack coming out of Guy's room with a bloody 2x4.
Not at all. Of course not.
I could see some of the tension begin to leave her face.
I hope you're right. I mean, I can see what you're saying. The truth is the truth. All I heard was a quarrel. I never heard Jack threaten him. Exactly, I said, with a glance at my watch. It was nearly 6 by then. If you're through for the night, I better let you go. I probably ought to get on out of here myself, but first I want to have a little chat with Christy. Anxiety flickered in her eyes.
You won't mention our conversation.
Would you quit worrying? I won't say a word, and I don't want you saying anything either.
I appreciate that. I believe I would like to go wash my face.
I waited until Myrna had disappeared through the utility room, moving toward her apartment. My tea was untouched. I emptied my cup and left it in the sink. Despite Enid's good example, I've never owned a dishwasher and don't know the first thing about loading one. I pictured one false move and every dish would go flying, crashing in a heap of rubble. I returned to the library. Christy and Tasha had turned on the television set. Christy held the remote, and she was switching from channel to channel to see if she could catch the news. She pressed the mute button when I came in, turning to look at me.
Oh, there you are. Come in and join us. Tasha thought you were gone.
I'm on my way, I said. I went out to the kitchen to see if I could help out there. Could I ask you a question before I take off? I heard you mention the mail when you were talking to Lieutenant Robb. Can I ask what that was?
Sure. Let's see. I guess late Monday afternoon someone put an unsigned letter in the mailbox. The envelope had Guy's name on it, but there was no return address. He left it on the hall table when he went to bed last night. I thought the police might want to take a look.
Was it typed or handwritten?
The envelope was typed.
Did you read the letter?
Of course not, but I know it bothered Guy. He didn't say what it was, but I gather it was something unpleasant.
Did he ever mention a Max Outhwaite? Does the name mean anything to you?
Not that I remember, she turned to Tasha. Does it ring a bell with you?
Tasha shook her head.
What's the connection?
That's how the reporter first heard Guy was back. Someone named Max Outhwaite dropped off a letter at the dispatch, but when Katzenbach checked it out, there was no one by that name and no such address. I double-checked as well and came up blank.
Never heard of him, Christy said. Is there any chance he's connected to one of Guy's old sprees? Maybe Outhwaite was somebody Guy mistreated back then.
Possible, I said. Do you mind if I check Bader's file upstairs?
What file? Tasha asked.
Christy answered before I did. Bader kept a folder of newspaper clippings about Guy's various arrests and his scrapes with the law. It goes back quite a way.
I'll tell you something else crossed my mind, I said. This Outhwaite, whoever he is, certainly put Jeff Katzenbach on the trail of Guy's criminal history. I'm not sure Jeff would have known about it otherwise. The minute I saw the letter, I remember wondering if it was really Bennett or Jack who tipped him off somehow.
Using Outhwaite's name?
It seems possible, I said.
But why would either of them do that? What's the point?
That's the problem. I don't know. Anyway, I could be off base on this one, I said. I do like the idea that Outhwaite's someone Guy sinned against in the old days.
Take the file if you want. It was still on the desk in Bader's office last I saw.
Let me pop upstairs and grab it. I'll be right back.
I moved out of the library and crossed the foyer. Maybe when I talked to Jonah, he'd level with me about the letter.
I went up the stairs two at a time, studiously avoiding a look down the hall. I had no idea which room Guy had been in, but I didn't want to go near it.
I took a hard left at the head of the stairs and went straight to Bader's room, where I opened the door and flipped on the overhead light.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
I took a hard left at the head of the stairs and went straight to Bader's room, where I opened the door and flipped on the overhead light. Everything seemed to be in order. The room was cold and smelled slightly musty from disuse. The overhead illumination was dim, and the pale colors in the room looked flat. I passed through to the office beyond, hitting switches as I went. Bader's life force was being systematically erased. Closets had been emptied. All the personal items removed from his desktop. I surveyed the surrounding area. I spotted the folder with all the newspaper articles about Guy's past behavior, relieved that the cops hadn't swept through and taken it. On the other hand, the search warrant probably wasn't that broad. The list of property to be seized might have been directed only toward the murder weapon itself. I leafed through the clippings, speed reading for content, looking for the name Outhwaite or anything close. There was nothing. I checked through some of the stray folders on the desk, but found nothing else that seemed relevant. One more dead end, though the idea was sound. Someone with a grudge making Guy's life difficult. I pressed the file under my arm and left the room, turning off the lights as I went. I pulled the door shut behind me, pausing in the hallway outside the master suite. Something felt wrong. My first urge was to scurry down the stairs toward the lighted rooms below, but I found myself slowing. I could hear a crackling sound, and I peered to my left. The far end of the corridor was enveloped in shadow, except for an X of crime scene tape across three doorways. As I watched, the tape seemed to become nearly luminous, vibrating audibly, as if rattled by wind. I thought for a moment the tape would break free, clicking and snapping as though a current were moving through it. The air on the landing was chilly, and there was the faint scent of something animal, wet dog or old fur. For the first time, I allowed myself to experience the horror of Guy's death. I began to descend, one hand on the railing, the other clutching the file. I pivoted, reluctant to turn my back on the darkness behind me. For a moment, I scrutinized the stretch of corridor I could see. Something hovered in my peripheral vision. I turned my head slowly, nearly moaning with fear. I could see sparkles of light, almost like dust motes materializing in the stillness. I felt a sudden flush of heat, and I could hear ringing in my ears, a sound I associated with childhood fainting spells. My phobia about needles had often inspired such episodes. When I was young, I was often subjected to a typhoid inoculation, a time test for tuberculosis, or a periodic tetanus injection. While the nurse took the time to poo-poo my fears, assuring me big girls didn't put up the fuss I did, the ringing would begin, building to a high pitch, and then silence. My vision would shrink, the light spiraling inward to a tiny point. The cold would rush up, and the next thing I'd know, there'd be anxious faces bending over me, and the sharp scent of smelling salts held under my nose. I leaned back against the wall, my mouth flooded with something that tasted like blood. I closed my eyes tightly, conscious of the thudding of my heart and the clamminess in my palms. While Guy Malik slept, someone had crept along this hallway in the darkness last night, toting a blunt object of sufficient brute matter to extinguish his life. Less than a day ago, less than a night. Perhaps it had taken one blow, perhaps several. What troubled me was the notion of that first bone-crushing crack as his skull shattered and collapsed. Poor Guy. I hoped he hadn't wakened before the first blow fell. Better he slept on before the last sleep became final. The ringing in my ears went on, mounting in intensity like the howling of wind. I was weighted with dread. Occasionally, in nightmares, I suffer from this effect. An overpowering urge to run without the ability to move. I struggled to make a sound. I would have sworn there was a presence, someone or something that hovered and then passed. I tried to open my eyes, almost convinced I'd see Guy Malik's killer passing down the stairs. My heartbeat accelerated to a life-threatening pitch, thrumming in my ears like the sound of running feet. I opened my eyes. The sound ceased abruptly. Nothing. No one. The ordinary noises of the house reasserted themselves. The scene before me was blank. Polished floor, empty hall, incandescent light from the chandelier. Glancing back down the corridor, I could see the X's of crime scene tape was simply tape again. I sank down on the stairs. The whole of the experience had surely taken less than a minute, but the rush of adrenaline had left my hands shaking. Finally, I roused myself from the step where I'd been sitting for God knows how long. From somewhere downstairs, I could hear a mix of male and female voices, and I knew without question that Donovan, Bennett, and Jack had returned from the police station, arriving while I was still in Vader's office. Below me, the library door stood open. Tasha and Christy must have gone to join them. Faintly, from the direction of the kitchen, I could hear the clatter of ice cubes and the clink of bottles. Drink time again. Everybody in the house seemed to need alcohol, along with extended psychiatric care. I completed my descent, anxious to avoid encountering the family. I returned to the library, peering in with caution, relieved to see the room empty. I grabbed up my handbag and shoved the file down in the outside pocket, then headed for the front door, heart still pounding. I pulled the door shut behind me, careful to soften the sound of the latch clicking into place. Somehow, it seemed important to slip away undetected. After my experience on the stairs, whatever it was, I was incapable of making superficial conversation. It didn't seem unreasonable to suppose that someone in this household had murdered Guy Malik, and I'd be damned if I'd make nice until I knew who it was. Chapter 15. Back in my neighborhood, parking spaces were at a premium, and I was forced to leave my VW almost a block away. I locked the car and trotted to my apartment. It was fully dark by then, and a chill shivered in the trees like wind. I crossed my arms for warmth, clutching the strap of my handbag as it bumped against my side. I used to carry a handgun as a matter of course, but I've given up that practice. I moved through the gate, which gave its usual welcoming squeak. My place was dark, but I could see the lights on in Henry's kitchen. I didn't want to be alone. I headed for his back door and rapped on the glass. He emerged moments later from the living room. He gave a half wave when he saw me and crossed to let me in.
I was just watching the news. The murder's on all channels. Sounds bad.
Awful. It's vile.
Have a seat and get warmed up. It's gotten nippy out there.
I said, don't let me interrupt. I'll be fine sitting here.
Don't be silly. You look cold.
I'm freezing.
Well, wrap up.
I put my bag down and grabbed his afghan, folding its weight around me like a shawl as I slid into his rocking chair.
Thanks. This is great. I'll be warmer in a minute. It's mostly tension. I'm not surprised. Have you eaten supper yet?
I think I had lunch, but I can't remember what I ate.
I've got beef stew if you want. I was just about to have a bowl myself.
Please. I watched as Henry adjusted the flame under the stew. He took out a loaf of homemade bread, sliced it thickly, and placed it in a basket with a napkin folded over it. He assembled bowls and spoons, napkins and wine glasses, moving around the kitchen with his usual ease and efficiency. Moments later, he set bowls of stew on the table. I left his rocking chair and shuffled over to the kitchen table still wrapped in his afghan. He pushed the butter in my direction as he settled in his chair.
So, tell me the story. I know the basic details. They've been blasting that across the TV screen all afternoon.
I began to eat as I talked, realizing how hungry I was.
You may know more than I do. I'm too smart to stick my nose in the middle of a homicide investigation. These days it's hard enough to put a case together without an outsider interfering. You're not exactly an amateur.
I'm not an expert either. Let the techs and forensic specialists give it their best shot. I'll keep my distance unless I'm told otherwise. My stake's personal, but it's really not my business. I liked Guy. He was nice. His brothers pissed me off. This is great stew.
You have a theory about the murder?
Let's put it this way. This is not a case where some stranger broke in and killed Guy in the middle of a robbery. The poor man was asleep. From what I heard, everybody'd been drinking, so he more than likely passed out. He wasn't used to hard liquor, especially in massive quantities, which is how the Maliks go at it. Somebody knew where his room was, and probably knew he was in no condition to defend himself. I tell you, with the possible exception of Christy, I've developed such an aversion to that family, I can hardly bear to be under the same roof with them. I feel guilty about Guy. I feel guilty about finding him, and guilty he came back. I don't know what else I could have done, but I wish I'd left him in Marcella where he was safe.
You didn't encourage him to return.
No, but I didn't argue that strenuously either. I should have been more explicit. I should have detailed their attitude.
I thought the danger was emotional. I didn't think anyone would go after him and bludgeon him to death.
You think it was one of his brothers?
I'm tempted by the idea, I said reluctantly. It's a dangerous assumption, and I know I shouldn't jump to conclusions, but it's always easier to pin suspicion on someone you dislike.
By 8:30 that night, I was back in my apartment with the door locked. I sat at the kitchen counter for what felt like an hour before I worked up the courage to call Peter and Winnie Antle, who'd been following the story on the Santa Maria news station. The entire church congregation had come together earlier that evening, shocked and saddened by the murder. I hoped to cushion their loss, though in reality their faith provided them more comfort than I was able to offer. I told them I'd do what I could to keep in touch, and I broke the connection, feeling little or no solace. Once the lights were turned out, I lay in my bed with a stack of quilts piled over me, trying to get warm, trying to make sense of what had happened that day. I was weighted with dread. Guy's death had generated something far worse than grief. What I experienced was not sorrow, but a heavy regret that was wedged in my chest like an undigested lump of hot meat. I didn't sleep well. My eyes seemed to come open every 20 minutes or so. I changed position and adjusted the covers. First I was too hot, then too cold. I kept thinking the next arrangement of limbs would offer sufficient comfort to lure me to sleep. I lay on my stomach with my arm shoved under my pillow, turned on my back with my shoulders uncovered. I tried my left side, knees pulled up, arms tucked under, switched to my right side with one foot sticking out. I must have set the alarm without thinking about it, because the next thing I knew, the damn thing was going off in my ear, bringing me straight up out of the only decent sleep I'd managed all night. I turned off the alarm. I refused to run. There was no way I was budging from the chrysalis of heat-generating quilts. Next thing I knew, it was 9:15, and I felt compelled to drag myself out of bed. I had a date with Jonah Robb down at the police station. I checked my reflection in the bathroom mirror. Nice. My color was bad, and I had bags under my eyes. As it turned out, it wasn't Jonah I spoke to, but Lieutenant Bauer. She kept me waiting for 15 minutes, sitting on a little two-person bench in what I suppose would be referred to as the lobby at the police station. Under the watchful gaze of the officer at the desk, I shifted in my seat and stared at the rack of crime prevention pamphlets. I also eavesdropped shamelessly while 6 whining drivers came to complain about their traffic tickets. Finally, Lieutenant Bauer peered around the door from the investigative division. Miss Milhone? I'd never met Betsy Bauer, but I'd been curious about her. The name suggested someone perky and blonde, a former varsity cheerleader with terrific thighs and no brains. To my dismay, Lieutenant Bauer was the least perky woman I'd had the pleasure to meet. She was the police equivalent of an Amazon. Statuesque, 8 inches taller than I, and probably 50 pounds heavier. She had dark hair that she wore skinned straight back, and little round gold-rimmed glasses. She had a flawless complexion. If she wore makeup at all, it was artfully done. When she spoke, I caught sight of endearingly crooked teeth, which I realized later might have explained her reluctance to smile. It was also possible she didn't like me and longed to squash me like a bug. I followed her into a small cubicle with 2 wooden chairs and a scratched wooden table that had a tendency to wobble if you tried to rest your arm on it, pretending to be relaxed. She had nothing with her, no pen, no legal pad, no file, no notes. She looked directly at me, offering a few brisk sentences, after which it was my turn. Somehow I had the feeling she'd remember every word I said. More likely, our conversation was being recorded surreptitiously. I would have done a furtive field check for wiring along the underside of the table, but I was worried about the wads of old chewing gum and dried boogers parked there. She said, "We appreciate your coming in. I understand you were hired by the estate to locate Guy Malik. Can you tell me how you went about that?" Her gaze was watchful, her manner subdued. The question caught me by surprise. I felt a sudden flash of fear, color rising in my cheeks, as if I'd just emerged from a tanning booth.
I stalled like a little airplane with a tank full of bad fuel. Too late, I realized I should have prepared for this. Ordinarily, I don't lie to police officers, because that would be very naughty, wouldn't it? At heart, I'm a law and order type. I believe in my country, the flag, paying taxes and parking tickets, returning library books on time, and crossing the street with the light. Also, I'm inclined to get tears in my eyes every time I hear the national anthem sung by somebody who really knows how to belt it out. Right then, however, I knew I was going to have to do a little verbal tap dance, because how I went about finding Guy Malik wasn't exactly legitimate. Neither Darcy Pascoe nor I had any business dipping into CFI's computer system to do a DMV check on a matter completely unrelated to an insurance claim. I'd probably violated some kind of civil ordinance or penal code number something-something. At the very least, the two of us were in serious breach of company policy, department regulations, common decency, and proper etiquette. This might well go down on my permanent record, something my elementary school principal had threatened me with every time I fled school with Jimmy Tate in the fifth and sixth grades. I didn't think what I'd done was a jailable offense, but I was, after all, sitting at the police station, and I did have my private investigator's license to protect. Since I'd now hesitated a conspicuous 5 seconds, I thought it was wise to launch in on something. I said, well, I met with Donovan, Bennett, and Jack Malik last Wednesday. In the course of those conversations, I was given Guy Malik's date of birth and his Social Security number. So, late in the day on Thursday, I went over to the DMV offices and asked the clerk if there was any record of a driver's license in Guy Malik's name. The information that came back was that his license had been surrendered in 1968, but that he'd been issued a California identification card. His mailing address was listed in Marcella, California. I reported that to Tasha Howard, the attorney for the estate, and to Donovan Malik, who authorized me to drive up to Marcella to verify the address. Marcella's a small town. I wasn't there 10 minutes before I got a line on Guy. Frankly, I didn't think he should come down here.
Why is that?
Hey, as long as my butt wasn't on the line, I didn't care who I ratted out here. His brothers were upset at having to give him a share of their father's estate. They felt he'd been paid all the monies he was entitled to. There was the issue of a second will, which came up missing when the old man died. Bennett was convinced his father had disinherited Guy, but since that will was never found, the prior will was the one being entered into probate. I did a little detour at that point, giving Lieutenant Bauer the gist of the business about Max Southwaite, whose letter to the dispatch had set all the adverse publicity in motion. She didn't leap up with excitement, but it did serve to distract her, I hoped, from the issue of my illegal computer access. She took me through a series of questions related to the Malik's attitude toward Guy, which I characterized as hostile. I told her about the outburst I'd witnessed between Donovan and Bennett. She asked me a number of pointed questions about Jack's statement regarding Guy, but I honestly couldn't think of anything he'd said that suggested a homicidal bent. In our initial conversation, he'd expressed bitterness at Guy's defection, but that had been almost 18 years ago, so I wasn't convinced it was relevant. Though I didn't say so to her, I'd pegged Jack as the family mascot, someone harmless and dog-like, trained to distract others with his antics. I didn't feature him as a prime player in any ongoing domestic drama.
"When did you last talk to Guy?" she asked.
"He called Monday night. He needed a break, so I drove over to the house and met him near the side gate. I was glad to hear from him. I'd been worried because I knew the media had picked up the story. Peter Antle, the pastor of his church up north, had been trying to get in touch with him. The house was literally under siege, and it wasn't possible to get a call through. I'd driven over there once before, hoping to make contact, and I'd just about given up."
"Why were you so interested in talking to him?"
"Largely because Peter and his wife Winnie were concerned."
"Aside from that?"
I stared at her, wondering what she had in mind. Did she think I was romantically involved?
"You never met Guy,"
I said, stating it as fact and not a question.
"No."
Her face was without animation. Her curiosity was professional and had an analytic cast to it.
That was her job, of course, but I found myself struggling to articulate his appeal. Guy Malik was a beautiful man, I said in a voice suddenly fragile. Inexplicably, I found myself pricked by grief, my eyes stung with tears. I could feel my face get puffy and my nose turn hot. It seemed odd that in Henry's company I'd felt nothing while there, but in the face of Betsy Bowers's cold authority, all my unprocessed sorrow was surfacing. I took a deep breath, trying to cover my emotions. I was avoiding her eyes, but she must have picked up on my distress because she produced a tissue.